So what we want to do today is finish up. It's 2.5 pages of material to finish up this chapter in which we were discussing the conditioned state of the soul, both from the perspective that Srila Prabhupada explained, using the word conditioned as it appears in the Shastra, and Nitai Gauranga gave us some insight from Western psychology. So I want to just carry this chapter through to its conclusion. There's a little bit more. I spoke at the end about the difference between Mayavad and Vaishnava philosophy on this point. I want to again go over this, read the very essential points, just to remind you, and then we'll go into actually the details, the specific details that the Shastra gives us of the how, the question how the soul is conditioned, and Nitai Gauranga, then Prabhu, then has something to say, and then, depending on the time, we will enter into the why it happens. All right, so picking up again on this very, very important point of the differentiation between the Mayavadi position and the Vaishnava position regarding transformation of consciousness. So, can consciousness really be transformed?
Yes.
I mean, is this really a fact, or is this just something I'm fumbling for to to patch over some obscure corner of our philosophy about which we're not really sure? So let's hear from Srila Prabhupada himself, writing in his purport to Srimad Bhagavatam, 5.11.11. Quotation. One should not think that all the interactions of the physical elements, gross and subtle, that cause, listen to this, the transformations of mind and consciousness are working independently. They are under the direction of the Supreme Personality of Godhead. In Bhagavad Gita 15.15, Krishna says that the Lord is situated in everyone's heart. Sarvasya cha ham hridi sannivishto matak smrita jnanam apoharam cha. As mentioned herein, Supersoul, Chetragya, is directing everyone. The living entity is also Chetragya, but the Supreme Chetragya is the Supreme Personality of Godhead. He is the witness and the order giver. Under his direction, everything takes place. Now listen to this. The different inclinations of the living entity are created by his own nature or his expectations, and he is trained by the Supreme Personality of Godhead through the agency of material nature. Now, was that clear? I mean, could anything be more clear than that? Is there a doubt in anyone's mind after hearing that?
No.
That is crystal clear. Yes, consciousness, the mind and consciousness are transformed, but not independently. It is all going on under the direction of the Supreme Personality of Godhead, who trains the living entity. Trains means the same point that we've been making about conditioning. Huh? How Pavlov trained his dogs. So Krishna trains the living entities to be conditioned through the agency of material nature. So this is a very, very effective analogy. So let us go on to comparing the Mayavadi doctrine with what we've just heard. The Mayavadis hold to the doctrine that consciousness is nirvikara, or untransformable. Thus, to explain the conditioned state, they resort to illusionism, that our present perceptions and conceptions of material existence are utterly subjective and insubstantial. Such perceptions and conceptions, they argue, are in every sense disconnected from reality. This logic of utter disconnection obliges the Mayavadis to decry perceptual and conceptual qualities in the Absolute Truth. Names, forms, characteristics, personalities, activities, and relationships are never more than hallucinations, because without exceptions, they have no existence in capital R reality. Was that clear?
Yes.
Okay. The Vaishnavas hold that mundane names, forms, characteristics, personalities, activities, and relationships are unreal because they are temporary. But still, Maya has real power to bewilder consciousness, because it is a perverted reflection of the real and original transcendental names, forms, characteristics, personalities, activities, and relationships eternally manifest in the spiritual world by Bhagavan Sri Krishna. Does anyone here know the official name of they're actually related to our Sampradaya, but in Karnataka, the Sampradaya coming from Sripad Madhvacharya. Of course, they are Dvaitavadis. They follow the Vedanta philosophy of Dvaita, but there is a special name for them. Even they use themselves. And we find that same name in Prabhupada's book. So does anyone know that term? Yes? Tattvavadis, yes. So why are they called Tattvavadis? It's because Sripad Madhvacharya says that everything is true, that there's truth to everything, even illusion. How can he say that? See, because he's radically, Madhvacharya's position is radically opposed to the Mayavadis, who are, they're technically known as Vivartavadis. Vivarta means illusion. So they're illusionists. They say, this doesn't exist. This pillar doesn't really exist. This doesn't really exist. I don't really exist. You don't really exist. We're all one. Ekka Brahma Dvitiya Nashti. There is only one Brahman. Dvitiya, anything else? Nashti, it is not. That's the way they interpret. The Vaishnavas say Ekka Brahma Dvitiya Nashti. They have a very simple, straightforward, and logically beautiful explanation. This is a Vedic statement. Ekka Brahma means there's only one God, there is no other God. Just like the Muslims say the same thing. Allah Akbar. God is one, and there is no other God than God. So this is how the Vaishnavas take Ekka Brahma Dvitiya Nashti. But the Mayavadis say, Brahman is one, meaning one monistic reality. We're all one. And apart from this oneness, Dvitiya Nashti, there is nothing. There is no second, there is nothing else. So, Madhvacharya's mission was to very strongly, he was a Vedantist, in a special sense of the term. Take the word danta, in Sanskrit it means tooth, and we have a very similar word dental in English. So, Vedanta means to without teeth or to break out the teeth. So, Madhvacharya appeared to break out the teeth of the Shankaracharya Advaita Vedanta philosophy. He broke his teeth, so it was just toothless. And so he did this by this. It's a beautiful argument. Tattvavadi, everything is true, even illusion, even something that's, you see, I take a favorite Mayavadi example of a snake and rope. So you're walking down a path, because here in Mayapur, not often, but sometimes you'll see a poisonous snake. They have here, of course, cobra, and they have another snake, Chandrabhora, which has these, it's called Chandrabhora because it has moon-like markings on the side. It's a viper. And so these are poisonous snakes to be avoided. So you might be walking down the footpath and at night, and in the moonlight, you see something stretch across the footpath. Looks like a snake. Big poisonous snake. Oh my God! Now actually it's a rope. Just someone left a rope there. But you think it's a snake. So, that's an illusion. But your reaction to it, it's a real reaction, is it not? Your heart pounds, you sweat, you start looking around, maybe there's a stick, I can beat the snake, or maybe I should just run away. You know, your mind becomes very disturbed. You call out, help, is anybody there? Is a snake, snake? You see, your reaction is very real. So this is the meaning of tattvabhava. Not to say that there is no such thing as mistake or illusion. Of course there is. But even if there is, because we take that mistake or illusion to be reality, therefore there is a real result. Just like if you are a businessman in the market and someone comes and makes a big purchase. You see, 500 rupee purchase. Now that's for these baniyas, these market men, that's a big day. You know, some white elephant from the West comes and flashing his money around and spends 500 rupees. Wow! Thank you, Ganesh. Thank you, Lakshmiji. You see? So he's very happy. But what if it turns out that 500 rupee note is a fake one? It's counterfeit. You see? Then he's very, very unhappy. So these are real reactions. First he was very happy, he was very joyful. And then when he finds out, when he takes it to the bank, and the bank will not accept that, it's worthless. You see that mark? That means it's not real. Oh my God, oh no! Then he's crying and he's lamenting. So these are real reactions. The note is illusion, alright. But your reaction to it is... It was real happiness and then real unhappiness. So this is Madhvacharya's philosophy. It's brilliant, brilliant philosophical position. So this is the point here. That Maya has real power to bewilder. Again, with the snake and the rope. Why are we scared of the rope? Because there is really such a thing as cobra or Chandrabhora. If that didn't exist... You see, Mayavadi philosophy is like everything is illusion. So, there is no snake. You know, there is no real 500 note. So then, how could you be fooled? You see, if nowhere in the world was there a poisonous snake, anywhere existing in the world, and you saw some rope laying on the road, why would you be afraid? It would never come in your mind to be afraid. Because there's nothing real to connect to that. If every 500 rupee note was false, just like in Burma, sometimes the government, they have this policy, suddenly overnight, they change the currency. Once I visited there, and they had just changed, the only valid note in the whole country was a 50, I've forgotten their denomination, baht or something maybe, but for some... Because they're run by generals, you know. And there's a joke in Burma, they say, these generals, many stars, no brain. So they made the only valid note in the whole country overnight is 55, but 55, you know. Not 50, not 100, but 55. You had to have a 55 but note. And then you could buy something. And if you had, you know, an old 20 note or 100, it was worthless. You could not spend it. You know, suddenly, overnight, they did that. So, you know... anyway, what was my point? I don't know why I started talking about 55 bucks. But anyway... anyway, if every 500... Yes, if the Indian government suddenly declared overnight that every 500 rupee note
is invalid. Suddenly, in the Telegraph tomorrow, you read, your 500 rupee notes are worthless. You see? So then, what would be the question of anyone being fooled? You go to the market, I want to buy this, I want to buy this, I want to buy this, I want to buy this. Fill up this bag and fill up this bag. And the shopkeeper is very happy. And then at the end, he calculates, that will be 500 rupees. And then you take out a 500 rupee note. But there's the Telegraph sitting on his desk. I'm sorry, sir, we cannot accept this. What do you mean? These are no longer valid. What? No, sorry, they're no longer. You see, who could you fool with a 500 rupee note if they were not, you know, if there was no reality to them whatsoever? You could not. So the point is that Maya is powerful because there is a reality behind her that she imitates. And that's how we are fooled. And we are really fooled. There is a, although we are fooled, there is a reality to that state of being fooled, you see. There's a difference between being not fooled and being fooled. That's obvious. I mean, anyone can understand that. There's a difference between an idiot who doesn't know, you know, if you, in some houses they sometimes artistically paint doors and windows, you know, as part of, not in India, I think, but in some of the more eccentric parts of Europe especially. So they'll paint on the side of a building a window, you see. So if there's some fool who thinks it's a real window, you see. Oh, what a nice window. What a nice view. He doesn't realize he's just looking at a painting. You know, he's certainly different. You know, he's certainly understood to be a different type of person than the person who knows it's a painting. You know, the other people think, there's something wrong with this person. You see. So that's the point. So the Mayavadis are quasi-atheists. They cannot accept Krishna as the supreme truth and supreme controller, although he declares this of himself in Bhagavad Gita 7.7 and 8.9. And the Mayavadis, of course, the followers of Shankaracharya, to them the Gita is Praman. But they cannot, although they accept Gita as Praman, as Shastric evidence, they can't accept it when Krishna says, I am the supreme truth and the supreme controller. Their search for God ends only with consciousness of the self. Thus they cannot accept that consciousness can be transformed. But it can be by Krishna's will. Srila Baladeva Vidyabhushan states above, that the realms of vikar, transformation, and vikar avarti, transcendence, are both under the authority of the Lord. The transcendental realm of the Lord's personal divine nature. The transcendental realm is of the Lord's personal divine nature. The material realm, which is the city of 11 gates, that's a quote from an Upanishad that Baladeva Vidyabhushan gives. And I don't know if here I explained, but I think there I explained that there's no, the city of 11 gates is, it's the same thing as in the Bhagavad Gita, the city of 9 gates. It's just a different enumeration. So there's no need to go into that. In other words, the human body is of a different nature, but a different nature than the divine nature of Vaikuntha, of course. But nonetheless, it is the property of the Lord. Here's that explanation. Okay. We are familiar with the city of 9 gates, Navadvara Pura, from Bhagavad Gita 5.13, in which the 2 eyes, 2 ears, 1 genital, 2 nostrils, 1 mouth, and 1 rectum are the gates. The city of 11 gates, Puram Ekadasha Dwaram, is just a different enumeration of the sensory openings that is taught in Katha Upanishad. These are Shrotra, hearing, Tvak, tactile sensation, chakshu, eyes, jiva, tongue as taster, vak, voice, pani, hands, pada, feet, payu, anus, upasta, genital, and manas, mind. The point is that both the spiritual and material realms are controlled and owned by the Lord, and the liberated soul, the Lord's pure devotee, knows both realms and indeed dwells within them. This is the point that Baladeva makes in his Govinda Bhasya commentary. The conditioned soul likewise dwells within both realms. The conditioned soul is also being purely spiritual, part and parcel of Vaikuntha, of Vaikuntha Dham. He is always an infinitesimal part and parcel of Lord Krishna's spiritual nature, but he has forgotten Krishna. Thus he is covered by ignorance of the Lord's form and his own spiritual form too. Remember I said yesterday there are two kinds of covering. One is Swarup Avarti, covering of knowledge of the Lord's form and or spiritual form, and the other is Guna Avarti, covering by the three modes of material nature. So, thus he is covered by ignorance of the Lord's form and of his own spiritual form too. In other words, he is diverted from the actual object of his desire, which is the transcendental satisfaction of loving exchange with the Lord. In his ignorance of spiritual form, the conditioned soul is further covered by the three modes of material nature, which means he takes on a material form. This is all effected by a transformation of consciousness. And so the conditioned soul experiences himself subject to birth, growth, sustenance, reproduction, dwindling, and death. Those again are the six famous transformations that are mentioned in many places. These six transformations are experienced because the conditioned soul finds his identity within eight kinds of elements in the form of the gross and subtle bodies: earth, water, fire, air, ether, mind, intelligence, and false ego. Through the agency of these gross and subtle energies, he acquires 13 kinds of senses. So this is a quotation from Srimad Bhagavatam, Canto 2, Chapter 2, Text 35, purport. All our ordinary actions and perceptions depend on various forms of energy supplied to us by nature in various combinations. Our senses of perception and of action, that is to say, are five perceptive senses of one, hearing, two, touch, three, sight, four, taste, and five, smell, as well as our five senses of action, namely hands, legs, speech, evacuation organs, and reproductive organs, and also our three subtle senses, namely mind, intelligence, and ego, 13 senses in all, are supplied to us by various arrangements of gross or subtle forms of natural energy. End of quote. The conditioned soul is covered by seven kinds of gross bodily layers. That is to say, skin, flesh, bone, muscles, marrow, fat, and semen. That's from Krishna Book Chapter 10, Prayers by the Demigods for Lord Krishna in the Womb. He is covered by five kinds of subtle conceptions imposed by the controlling deity of the mind, the moon. These five are Anamaya, the conception that life is food; Pranamaya, the conception that life is bodily movement, like breathing. You see, if you see a body laying on the roadside, you might get worried, but if you see the lungs moving, then at least you know he's still alive. Manomaya, the conception that the good life is the culture of the mind; Vijnanamaya, the conception that the better life is the culture of discrimination; and Anandamaya, the conception that the best life is full of bliss, is full of the bliss of self-realization. So for this you can see Srimad Bhagavatam 5.22, 9, 10, and 6, 15, 12 through 15 purports. In the subtle body are manifest the living symptoms, which are consciousness and convictions. See Bhagavad Gita 11, 6, and 7 purports. The interaction of the five elements of the gross body gives rise to desire, hatred, happiness, and distress. See the same purport to verses 6 and 7 in chapter 13, Bhagavad Gita. The conditioned soul is beaten by the six material whips: hunger, thirst, lamentation, illusion, old age, and death. See Srimad Bhagavatam 5.135. He becomes addicted to the four acts of conditioned life: eating, sleeping, mating, and defending. He is tempted by the four vices of conditioned life, which are illicit sex, gambling, intoxication, and meat eating. By committing these, the soul passes through the three gates to hell, which are what? Lust, anger, and greed. Or it may be said that he falls into the clutches of six enemies. See Srimad Bhagavatam 7.7.33. which are lust, anger, greed, illusion, madness, and jealousy. He can avoid hell and the six enemies by passing religiously through the four stages of regulated material life, dharma, artha, kama, and moksha. In any case, he is subject to the fourfold material miseries, birth, death, old age, and disease. The six transformations and all the other permutations associated with them manifest within the field of material activity, consisting of 24 components. This is from Bhagavad Gita 13:6-7. Most of these 24 have been mentioned already. Here I shall simply summarize them. There are five gross elements called Mahabhutas, three subtle elements, the unmanifested stage of the three modes of material nature called Abhyakta, five knowledge-acquiring senses, five working senses, and five sense objects. Idam shariram kaunteya chetram iti abhidhiyate. This body, O son of Kunti, is called the field, or chetra, from Bhagavad Gita 12:2. Thus the field of 24 components is the material body, the city of 9 or 11 gates. How consciousness is transformed and how the field of activity manifests from the three modes of material nature is the subject of the next part of this essay. But now we will turn the floor over to our beloved Nitai Gaura Sundar Prabhu, who is shortly making a trip to Paris to see the Eiffel Tower. I hope I didn't baffle him.
There we go.
Didn't do that. But he just couldn't help but mention it.
I know. Okay. For I think most people were here 2 days ago, and we were speaking about classical conditioning and operant conditioning. Is there anyone here who recalls what the difference is, or anyone can say what classical conditioning is? Any star students that were paying attention and looking at my hideous diagrams on the board? Okay, never mind. Classical conditioning is the example of Pavlov's dogs, that the dog has a response to food which is salivating, while you ring a bell when you give him the food, and then slowly after time take the food away, the dog will begin to salivate according to the sound of the bell. So that way a conditioned response is linked to a conditioned stimulus. When the bell rings, the dog drools. And then there is operant conditioning, which the basic principle of operant conditioning means that a behavior that is reinforced will tend to be repeated, and a behavior that is punished will tend to be to become extinct. So the latter one, the operant conditioning, is really what has more to say about the human condition. And this was the discovery and made popular by B.F. Skinner, who we spoke about 2 days ago. Actually, the first time I said his name, I referred to him as B.S. Skinner, but that was a Freudian slip. Kind of funny. But anyway, let's get into a little bit of what his idea was. He wasn't merely just his idea of operant conditioning, that a behavior that is punished is going to become extinct and a behavior that is rewarded is going to be repeated, is not just a mere descriptive science, but B.F. Skinner's idea was that through this mechanism of operant conditioning that we can engineer society. He claimed that if you give him 12 newborn children, he can create 12 completely different people according to his will. That according to raising them and rewarding certain ideas, certain behaviors, and punishing others, that you can raise them into whatever you damn well please, basically.
He was never a parent.
But yeah, I don't think he was. Yeah, he was also quite strange. So his idea ultimately was to create utopia in this way. He wrote a couple of books. And one of his more famous books was one called Beyond Freedom and Dignity. And the main quotation or the main phrase of this book that kind of sums up the whole idea is no praise, no blame. Does anyone want to take a gander at what he was getting at when he says no praise, no blame?
It sounds like Buddhism.
It sounds like Buddhism.
It sounds like a humanistic psychology.
I would say it's almost, in a sense, there, it's almost diametrically opposed to it. In a sense. Anyone else want to take a guess? No praise, no blame, yes.
What's the connection with people, society?
Hmm? In a sense, but the in a sense.
So there is similar to what humans rationality.
Hmm?
There is some text which is mentioned. So what you don't praise or blame someone.
Uh-huh. It's approaching his idea at least.
And it reminds me about this.
Mm-hmm. It's approaching his idea. The idea is that we, as humans, are failing to understand the real determinants of human behavior. That human behavior is not a product of someone's internal moral compass, their idea of right and wrong, their aspirations, their desires. But actually, he would say that human behavior is a result of the environment. That human behavior is a result of this history that someone goes through of rewards and punishments. That because someone was rewarded and punished in a certain way, they've become a certain person. And so actually it has nothing to do with the personality per se. Nothing to do with what goes on inside the person's mind, with the person's desires. But actually the person is 100% a result of how he was raised, how he was rewarded for behaviors and how he was punished for behaviors. Now, I have to temper that statement somewhat because it seems quite radical, and indeed it is. But the way psychological theorists work and have to work is that you have to make a wild and radical statement in order to be recognized. If you said, you know, it's pretty important how people are punished and how people are rewarded, and that does something. You know, that does something to a person. People are going to say, "Oh, okay, no big deal." When you write a book called Beyond Freedom and Dignity, meaning that a person doesn't have any freedom. There is no dignity of being righteous, of being a saint, what have you. There is just the fact that we're products of our environment and how we were raised, basically. So to make a strong statement like that is to bring these ideas into a starker contrast with the rest of psychological thought as it was at the time. So I think a good example of how this works. And I think it does work to some extent, but we can take a closer look at it, how complex it is. It's more complex than this Skinnerian box that I was talking about on Monday, where the rat hits the bar, nothing happens, and then all of a sudden the food starts coming out, so it hits the bar a whole lot more because it's getting rewarded. When the rat is not getting rewarded, there's no food coming out, it doesn't push the bar anymore. But human behavior is much more complex than that. So one example I heard from one professor is that when he is advising students, sometimes he'll get a student who is pre-med, and so he'll have a little fun with that person, and ask them, you know, oh, so is your mother or father a doctor? And they may say no, just, you know, maybe an uncle, no, you know, well, do you understand, you know, how rigorous medical school is, and you know, and how much work is going to be and how dedicated of a life it is to go through medical school. And then, yeah, you know, I've wanted to be a doctor my whole life. And so he'll question, oh, so when you were six weeks old, you wanted to be a doctor? No, not when I was that old, but, you know, when I was very young. But the idea that he tries to get at is this, that let's say the young lad comes home one day when he's 4 years old and he says, you know, I want to be a fireman. And his parents will say, oh, okay, you know, go, time for dinner, go wash your hands. And okay, so then, you know, so that idea, not terribly rewarded, nothing really said about it. And then maybe a couple months later he comes and I want to be, you know, I want to be a garbage man. Actually, I want to be a garbage man when I was young. I just look like fun to ride on the back of the truck. But so I want to be a garbage man. No, okay, yeah. You know, I want to be this. I want to be that. Nothing. You know. Okay. I want to be a doctor. And so I think oftentimes when a child would come out with something like this, the parents would start to think, oh, you know, a kid can make a lot of money and be really successful. Okay, wow, that's a great idea. Really, what a good idea. You want to be a doctor. Wow. And, you know, they tell grandma, and grandma tells everyone, you know, my grandson's going to be a doctor. And so in this way, there's constant reward. And so the person thinks after some time that, yes, I want to be a doctor. But Skinner's point here is that the person doesn't want to be a doctor because he thinks he wants to be a doctor. He wants to be a doctor because he's been rewarded in that way. And that actually, his desire to be a doctor is not a result of his thought processes. The thoughts do not yield the behaviors, but it's the other way around. The behaviors specifically the behaviors that are rewarded are what yield the thought processes. Someone thinks they want to be a doctor because they've been rewarded that way. So the thoughts are actually secondary to the behaviors. This is actually Skinner's very revolutionary idea at the time, and in many ways changed the face of psychology at the time. Now, I have two interesting examples that are even more complex than that, and I think these relate more to Vaishnava theology and the conditioning of the soul. We were talking about Patty Hearst on Monday, and what's the name of the liberation?
Symbionese Liberation Army.
The SLA. Patty Hearst was kidnapped by the SLA. She was the daughter of a famous. He was the head of a newspaper company, and a very influential rich person. She was the heiress to this dynasty, what have you. And she was kidnapped by these people, and she, according to her, she had to make statements against her father. So I actually watched the documentary just a couple, 2 weeks before I came to Mayapur. It's quite interesting. She was forced to make statements against her father, saying that, against the political parties that this Liberation Army was opposing, and she said, I lost the quote. It's in there somewhere, in this computer somewhere. But by parroting these phrases over and over again, that these people are wrong, that actually what's right is this, that in time she came to believe it herself, and she became the poster child of the Symbionese Liberation Army, with a picture of her holding an AK-47. It's actually a pretty cool picture, if you ask me. So that's one example. And here's another example, and then we'll get to how these relate to operant conditioning. There was, during the time of World War II, there was a group of older men that were German, but they weren't indoctrinated into the SS or anything like that. They were, I think, generally in their mid to late 40s, sometimes their 50s, and they were recruited as a police battalion. Basically, it was just a job for them. They weren't Nazis in the standard sense of the term. Maybe there was some slight anti-Semitic feelings in them, but nothing so profound as what the SS were indoctrinated into. So the police battalion, basically, they were like military police, and the way they were brought up in this unit was that they had very close connections with each other. And the head of the battalion, they referred to this specific battalion that I did a study on. They referred to the head of the battalion as Papa. I can't remember his last name, Papa so and so, and it was a very family type feel to it. And so after some time of acting as military police, they were brought into Poland, and it was transcribed actually this speech that the head of the battalion gave said. That he feels sorry that he has to give such bad news, but the assignment that they gave in this day was quite gruesome. And he said, unfortunately, our job today is to go into this village, to round up every Jewish person, to shoot them individually in the back of the head and kill them. So, you know, prior to that, they probably had never fired their guns once. They had no real vested interest in murdering Jewish people. But he's and the head of the battalion said, I know this is difficult, and if anyone wants to back out, they can. But actually, none of them backed out. They all proceeded, and with a sense of duty, not necessarily to the ideals of the Nazi front, but of the feelings that if one of them had to do it, then they all had to do it. It was a family type of environment, so they felt, let's all do it then. Since we can't necessarily back out of this as a whole. So feeling duty-bound, they went and did it, but as is described, some of them kind of walked around the periphery of the village and just didn't do anything. Some of them became quite disgusted, were vomiting when they were doing it, etc., etc., etc. And that night, all of them got extremely drunk, didn't speak about it at all. But then, after this mission, so to speak, was completed, they actually started receiving more assignments like this, where they would have to go and murder the Jewish population in any given village. And so it became much more common that this is what they had to do. Now, over time, what started to happen was this, that they began to talk about it more openly. And in time, they began to even gloat about it a bit. And in time, they began to revel in it. They began to talk about it with that it was glorious how they killed so many Jews today. They began to even write songs about it, about the one song they wrote made a reference to Nusskrochen, which means to crack someone's skull open. So the question is, how could someone go from not being personally invested in it and actually being quite sickened by it to taking joy in it, to taking pleasure in it? Or how could Patty Hearst go from being the, you know, generally run-of-the-mill daughter of her rich father and to speaking out against her father to, I found out she never did shoot anyone, but she held up a number of banks at gunpoint with the rest of her group. She also renounced her fiancé publicly on television, etc., etc., etc. So what is it that makes a person do this? I think this has a lot of connections to what makes an individual's soul leave the spiritual world, what makes it accept the false designation of the body, and what makes that soul accept the inferior material pleasure in exchange of not tasting spiritual rasa, which is far superior. I think that all of these have to do with the conception of self one has. The conception of self and the preservation of that self, and that rewards and punishments, or what's good and bad, are seen in light of this. So in the case of Patty Hearst, the idea was that if she didn't cooperate with the Liberation Army, that she may be killed, that her father may be targeted next, etc., etc. That with the police battalion, that a higher principle was to not betray their fellows in the battalion, not to betray the order of the battalion. And I would say that with the spirit soul entering the material world, that it's the soul's enmity towards God and its desire to enjoy separately from God that reworks or reformulates what is good, what is bad, what is positive, what is negative, what is desirable and what is not desirable. So therefore, we can see how complicated this idea of rewards and punishments is and how it's reflected on one's sense of self. And I would say that, in a nutshell, is Skinner's idea of operant conditioning and how it relates to human behavior. That's all I have to say about human conditioning.
So, yeah, that's interesting. So he's given us some analogies, useful analogies from Western psychology. But now we want to go from analogy to the direct statements of Shastra. So this section that we started, when was it? I guess yesterday, day before yesterday. This is, remember, you might remember, it's called a Vedic schema of the mind and its processes. I forgot if we started this on Monday or last Friday. And now we are on part two. And this is called, has some interesting Sanskrit terms, Mahasamasti, Samasti, and Vyasti. And the subtitle is How Consciousness is Conditioned. So I'm going to begin by reading a series of verses. And these verses I'm not going to explain immediately after I read each one, but there will be an explanation that follows their reading. So you just have to bear with me, but I think you'll find these verses very interesting. So, these verses lay down a foundation. There's six scriptural quotations. And our schema, remember we're using this word, we've taken this word from psychology, and it means a model, or the model that we get from the Srimad Bhagavatam, that is making a very complex subject matter, a subject matter that Srila Prabhupada and the other acharyas ultimately says it becomes inconceivable. But it's making it at least to some degree understandable to us. So the first quotation is from Taittiriya Upanishad. This is chapter 2, verse 7. It's a very nice verse. Raso vaisaha rasam hi evayam labdhanana nibhavati Kohi evanya ka pranyat ya esha akasha anando nasyat esha hi esha nandayati. That means that the supreme truth is rasa. The jiva becomes blissful on attaining this rasa. Who would work with the body and prana, or the sensory powers, if this blissful form did not exist? He gives bliss to all. The next quotation is from Srimad Bhagavatam, Canto 3, Chapter 25, Verse 15. I guess there's no need to read the Sanskrit, but if you're interested, you can note down the number of the verse and look at it yourself. But the translation reads, the stage in which consciousness, the consciousness of the living entity, is attracted by the three modes of material nature is called conditioned life. But when that same consciousness is attached to the Supreme Personality of Godhead, one is situated in the consciousness of liberation. Then from Srimad Bhagavatam, 3, 32:19, translation. Now this is the reverse verse I referred to yesterday. Maybe I should read the Sanskrit of this one. That nunam daivena vihata ye chachuchya kata sudham hitva shinvanti asadgata purusham eva vidbujaha. Who here knows what the word vidbujaha means? Anyone know? It means stool eater. Stool eating hog. So the translation of this verse is such persons, means such persons who are accepting life in the material world, accepting the body as a self, accepting sense gratification as the standard of happiness. Such persons are condemned by the supreme order of the Lord because they are averse to the nectar of the activities of the Supreme Personality of Godhead. They are compared to stool-eating hogs. They give up hearing the transcendental activities of the Lord and indulge in hearing of the abominable activities of material persons. Then from the Rig Veda, this is Mandala 10, 129:4. So this is a very significant statement that kamastad agre sama avartadi manasa retaha prataman yadusit. And this means, in the beginning there was desire, which was the primal germ of the mind. Then, from Srimad Bhagavatam 7:9:42, this is from Prahlad Maharaj, he states, O best of the great personalities, I am not at all afraid of material existence. For wherever I stay, I am fully absorbed in thoughts of your glories and activities. My concern is only for the fools and rascals who are making elaborate plans for material happiness and maintaining their families, societies, and countries. I am simply concerned with love for them. And then Srimad Bhagavatam 10:1:4, translation. Glorification of the Supreme Personality of Godhead is performed in the parampara system. That is, it is conveyed from spiritual master to disciple. Such glorification is relished by those no longer interested in the false temporary glorification of this cosmic manifestation. Descriptions of the Lord are the right medicine for the conditioned soul undergoing repeated birth and death. Therefore, who will cease hearing such glorification of the Lord except a butcher or one who is killing his own self? So those were the verses that lay down the foundation, and now I want to elaborate. The first quotation informs us that the absolute truth is rasa, the reservoir of pleasure for everyone. Even jivas in the conditioned state who work with physical bodies, that was very clearly stated. Even for the jivas who are in the physical consciousness, who are just working with their bodies for sense gratification, the absolute truth, or the driving force, or the motivating principle, is rasa. And rasa is God. In the beginning of his Bhakti Rasamrita Sindhu, Nectar of Devotion, Srila Rupa Goswami testifies that Lord Krishna is the Kila Rasamrita Murti. The form of Akila in Sanskrit means universal. So Akila Rasamrita Murti is a very significant name that Rupa Goswami gives to Krishna. Rasamrita, rasa, Amrita, the nectar of rasa, murti, the form of, and then akila, the adjective in the front, means all kinds throughout the universe. He is the form of the nectar of the rasa that all kinds of living entities all over the universe are enjoying. The word akila is rendered by Srila Prabhupada as meaning, this is from different translations I found, all kinds, all sorts, universal, all that be, complete, and so on. The second quotation, spoken by Lord Kapiladev, tells us that the living entities are grouped into two categories, conditioned and liberated, by the quality of their attraction. Or in other words, by the quality of their rasa. Yes. Liberated souls are attracted to Krishna. Yes. And they obtain akila rasa, the complete taste of nectar. Conditioned souls are attracted to the modes of nature, and they obtain kila, or incomplete, or jada, dead, insentient rasa. Jada rasa is a term that Srila Prabhupada would often, we find this often not only Srila Prabhupada, Bhaktisiddhanta Saraswati Thakur, Bhaktivinoda Thakur, jada rasa, the enjoyment of dead things. It's a rather, we could even use the rude word, brutal assessment of material sense gratification, but that's exactly what it is. Because as Prabhupada would often point out, this body is already dead. These material bodies are already dead. It's simply that temporarily there's a soul associating with them and therefore it's moving about. But the substance of the body is already dead matter. So one who tries to enjoy this body, who tries to bring sense objects to the various sensory portals of this body and taste nectar that way, that enjoyment is called jada rasa. It is enjoyment of a dead thing. The body itself is dead, and those sense objects one is bringing to the portals of the senses, they're also dead matter. So it's zombie life. I sometimes sarcastically refer to material life as zombie life. Because, you know, the zombies, the walking dead. So, conditioned souls are attracted to the modes of nature. Yes, I read that. In a Srimad Bhagavatam lecture given on 7 December 1974 in Bombay, can someone turn on this light? Because it's getting, it's cloudy and I'm having a hard time to read this. I think it's a third on the top, yeah. Okay, that makes it a little better. So in Srimad Bhagavatam lecture given on 7 December 1974 in Bombay, Srila Prabhupada explained, you are captivated by this material jada rasa, material rasa. There is rasa. Otherwise, why a man is working so hard to maintain the family? Unless there is some ananda, why is he taking? Nobody is taking so much hard responsibility for others. But children, wife, family, they take. There is. Unless there is some ananda, how can he take? So the relationship has got ananda, but this ananda is flickering, illusion. At this point, it is opportune to introduce the words samasti and vyasti, which appear in the title of this second part of this essay. Sama means same. Vyasa means divided. And asti means it is so. The Lord is akila, universal, all that is, etc. Thus his point of view is samasti, as we see in Gita 15:7, mama aivam sajiva loki jiva bhuta sanatana, which means the living entities in this conditional world are my eternal fragmental parts. You see, Krishna is He has the samasti point of view. He sees all living entities. He is conscious of every living entity in existence as being his eternal part and parcel. But the point of view of the conditioned souls is that they are divided, vyasti, by matter, from God and from one another. In fact, the very word jiva or jiva bhuta carries with it the sense of this division. Quote, in the conditioned state, the living entity is known as the jiva bhuta, or the living force within matter. That's from Chaitanya Charitamrita, Madhya 6, 269 purport. In the same purport, Srila Prabhupada explains that the liberated soul is called Brahma Bhuta. Srimad Bhagavatam, 1.3.32 states, Sajivo Vai Punarbhavaha. The jiva takes repeated births. Similarly, 4.29.74, Srimad Bhagavatam tells us, jiva iti obidhiyate, that the jiva is understood as the chetana, conscious living entity, that is yuktaha, combined with shodasha, what is it? Shodasha vishishtam, 16 expansions, namely the 5 sense objects, the 5 sense, or the 5 active sense organs, the 5 knowledge acquiring senses, and the mind.
Sorry, fourth canto?
This is, yes, 4.29.74. So the jiva, this is the way this word is to be understood. That a jiva is one who is yukta, combined with sodasya vishishtam. These are 16 expansions of the Lord's energy. That there are 5 tanmatras, or perceptions. There are 5 jnanindriyas, there are 5 karmindriyas, and there is 1 manas, or mind. That is a jiva. So, in other words, the jiva exists as something that is vyasti, separated from the Lord. That is called the jiva. And when the jiva is not separated from the Lord, he is called Brahma-bhuta. Bhuta means living entity. He's a living entity, but he's of the quality of Brahman. Just like Krishna says in Gita, Brahmante, they are as Brahman. Because they know everything about transcendental activities. They are engaged in the transcendental activities of my devotional service, therefore Brahmante, they are Brahman. The third quotation, also spoken by Lord Kapila, explains that those divided from the Lord are most unfortunate. They are averse to Akila Rasa, which appears in this world as, the verse said, this Akila Rasa appears as Achyuta Kata. You know what the meaning of this? Achyuta is the name of Krishna, and Kata means discussions about. So it's not that this world is devoid of transcendental rasa. It's not that we're just thrown into this, you know, we're kicked out of the spiritual world where the rasa is going on, where Krishna's calling the gopis with his flutes, and here we are, you know, in Bengal, or wherever we are, sitting miserably, don't know what to do, and the date palms are getting nice and ripe now, and the men are going with their pots and milking out the date ras, and that's for sale, and one can drink the date. There's some ras for us, you see. You see, you can see them with the pots. And you see down by the Ganga, they have like a, it's like a bar by the roadside. I mean, it's just some guys with pots sitting by the road, and they sell for some paisa in little cups this white drink. And then you see these men sitting there. It must be heavy drink. I mean, if you look up at their faces, their eyes are red and staring in different directions. Really.
Well, I won't say. There's a term we used for that sort of state of mind. But we can't use that in this class context. Anyway, they're really messed up, put it that way. So, it's not that that's the only rasa in this material world. There is transcendental rasa, akila rasa, complete rasa, in the form of a chuta katha, discussions about Krishna. Those who have no taste for Krishna consciousness are compared to stool-eating hogs, that is. There is a rasa they are mad after, but unhappily, it is the taste to hear, discuss, and imitate the nasty affairs of animalistic people. And that's what the entertainment industry is all about, all over the world. Unfortunately, it is just as true here in India as it is in the West. In the West, you know, there's the movie capital Hollywood in California. And there's all these generally very degraded persons who become actors and actresses. I mean, their personal lifestyle is most abominable. They're intoxicated. They have illicit sex. There's one I've sometimes seen. There's one. It's a kind of sensationalistic news, sort of a news program that comes on sometimes, and I've seen it once in a while. It's called Celebrities Uncensored, I think. And so they're called paparazzi. These reporters that go out looking for scandals, and they have their little video cameras and their digital cameras, and they go out to the clubs on Sunset Strip to catch shots of Hollywood stars coming out drunk out of their minds or in a bad mood. And sometimes you see, you know, the camera's there, and here comes some famous star, either movie star or rock star, and the guy sees the camera on him and just gets furious. You just see fury enter his face, and then you see him pull back his fist, and then the camera goes black because the fist goes right into the lens, and then the next thing is the camera's on the ground looking across the street. There's track. You see the tires of cars going back and forth, and so these characters are abominable. You know, they're drunk and they're nasty and angry and they're cursing and they're always giving this what I call the shudra mudra to the camera, they're just very, very nasty people. And then in India, you've got Bollywood, and these people are no better. They're just drunkards and meat eaters. And I remember once seeing there's Indian newspapers like to cover the stories of the stars. So I remember once seeing Preeti something. Anyway, she's very famous. She's in all the Pepsi or Coke ads. We always see her. And then she was going to dinner, some restaurant with another actress. And you see, they're both very beautiful women, stylishly dressed. And you see them coming into the restaurant arm in arm, and they're laughing. And then they sit down at the restaurant, and all the waiters are there. And then you see, it was a series of snaps, you see. And you see them making their order like this. And then you see what's brought before them. It's some, it was some unrecognizable, but it was obviously a poor animal. What it had been, I couldn't recognize. It was, but I just saw, you know, burned meat and bones sticking out. And, a dead carcass, you know. A dead carcass. It was a big one, too, quite big one. It was set down in a tray in front of them. And there was some, you know, vegetable dressing around it. And these two women, they're sitting there, and still with their big smiles, pearly white teeth, and eating, you know, pulling the flesh off the bones, and stuffing it in them. laughing and telling jokes. And, you know. And this is for the whole of, you know, the whole of simple people in India, village people who just eat dal rice chapatis. So they worship this Preeti, whatever her name is. They see her, you know, holding up cans of Pepsi, bottles of Pepsi Cola. Every Bengali village, you see this woman, you see. And then they can see what she eats. So if she eats like that, then we should also eat like that. That's how people think. So this is going on. Instead of being attracted to glorifying Krishna, who is the real star, there's actually in the Bhagavatam, first canto, the name Natyadhara is given as the name of Krishna. And Natyadhara means the greatest actor. So Krishna is the greatest, he's the number one star of all eternity. The most handsome, he does the most heroic deeds, he has the most girlfriends, he's, you know, has the most money. He has the most beautiful wife. He has, you know, the best vehicle, Garuda, you know, riding around in a 2006 Garuda. Golden Garuda. Who can beat Krishna? But they're not attracted to him. They don't want to discuss Krishna. I mean, I have met so many. It started in the West, you know. I meet these Indian people who had come to the West. And they would see me, the way I'm dressed, and they would be interested. And, you know, they'd always think if I'm a member of Ramakrishna Mission or something like that. And I say, no, I'm Hare Krishna. Oh, Hare Krishna, what is that? I say, we're Vaishnavas, we worship Krishna. Have you read Bhagavad Gita? Oh yes, I have gone through that book. So immediately they, yes, yes, Krishna, yes. Don't tell me anymore, please. And then I thought India would be better, but in India I met also the same thing, so many, many. Yes, Krishna, we know. Yes, 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 Krishna, yes, yes, we know. Don't say anymore, please. But then you talk about Amitabh Bachchan. Oh, oh, Amitabh, where is he? I want his autograph. Shahrukh Khan? Shahrukh Khan? Where is he? Then all the Baba, you know, all the Anu Baba, Satika Baba. And these people are just ordinary nonsense rascals. The Shah Rukh Khan, he did a show, because in India, at least one thing, these actors, they're more honestly shudras than in Hollywood. See, in Hollywood, they act like royalty. But in Bollywood, you can hire them. A rich man can hire these, even big actors for weddings, and they'll come and they'll sing and dance, because that's all they are. They're just show people. So Shah Rukh Khan was at some gathering in Kerala. And I guess he's a Bombay Wala or something. So he speaks Hindi. And in Kerala they speak Malayalam, which is a very different language. So he was on stage. And then he started calling out to the audience, I want to know dirty words in Malayalam. So the people started shouting, you know, all the filthy words in their language. And then he would shout it out over the microphone. What is that? What is that? And then he would, over the microphone, and then everyone would go, yeah, yeah, yeah. You know, well, I mean, that's kirtan. That's a kind of kirtan, but it's Asura kirtan. It's Kali Yuga kirtan. Everyone chanting and hearing, and, you know, he's leading, and they're following, you know, it's kirtan, but what are they chanting? The most, you know, nasty words. So you see, the same thing is going on. Same thing. They're worshipping someone. They're chanting. They're glorifying. They're all gathering together. Samkirtan. But before we read about the gates to hell, this is the kind of Samkirtan that leads one through the gates to hell, to Naraka Loka. So, the light is very dark. Anyway, I can read a little bit here. So we will continue. The sixth, oh yes, the sixth quotation instructs us that while pure glorification of the Lord is the satisfaction relished by liberated souls, it is also the medicine for curing the conditioned souls of their spiritual weakness, strong material desires, and dissatisfaction. Only very unfortunate persons, infected with extreme self-loathing, because the verse talks about pashugna. So pashu has two meanings. It can mean animal or it can mean soul. So pashugna, and gna means killer. So one could be a butcher. So one that was a butcher, that's an extremely nasty business, you see. In America, they've done studies. Those butchers who kill animals, they have not done studies, but I guess it's a result of studying human behavior somehow or other. I don't know if in formal psychological studies, I guess, the school of hard knocks, but they've found in these slaughterhouses that they have to give these men who kill the animals, regular weeks off. They let them work for a couple weeks, and then for a couple weeks, they get a paid time off. Because killing those animals again and again, then they become mad, and the bloodlust in them becomes so strong that they become dangerous. They become dangerous to one another, to other workers. You know, I don't want to even describe how they kill the animals. It's very horrible, and they've got these weapons around, and so the company policy is always after a couple of weeks to let them go, because then they become a danger to other workers. They'll start, if they just kept working, they would just start killing the guy next to them. You see, just killing, going home and killing their families. You know, they just kill crazy. So that's pashugna, that's butcher. So a butcher, in other words, a person who can be a butcher is a crazy person. A person who can do that sort of thing is definitely not of sound mind, and experience proves it. But the real meaning of pashugna, pashu taken as the soul, so one who is like that, an animal killer, or a person who is just sworn to sense gratification, like in that nice song, Hari Hari Bipale Janama Goinanu, by Narottam Das Thakur. Janya Bishakainu? Janya Shunina Bishakainu. I have been, since my birth, drinking bisha, means poison. Knowing that, because he's writing as a person of Bengal who knows about, that was just after the time of Chaitanya Mahaprabhu. You see, just Narottam Das Thakur lived, I think, just about one generation after Chaitanya Mahaprabhu. So that means that the movement of Mahaprabhu, his Sankirtan movement, was all widespread all over Bengal. Everyone knew it. Everyone knew about the chanting of Hare Krishna, and everyone was seeing devotees intoxicated with love of Godhead. But taking the in this song, the station of an unfortunate soul, he says, knowingly, even though I know that to chant the glories of Krishna will give me the real taste of nectar, still I am drinking poison, the poison of sense gratification. So this is suicide. So therefore, in Upanishad, that term Atmahan is used, killer of the soul. A killer of the soul. And the one who refuses to take up spiritual life, who remains determined to simply enjoy the senses. So this is the meaning, this is why I've written here, a victim of extreme self-loathing. A person who actually, and Bhagavatam actually uses that. There's, I think later on in this essay, I quote the verse, where Srimad Bhagavatam actually says that such people, their hatred is for themselves. They hate Krishna, of course, but they hate themselves also as spirit soul. Therefore, they're trying to erase themselves as spirit soul. They're trying to erase their spiritual life completely. And therefore, they engage in these terrible tamasic activities. So only a person who is infected with extreme self-loathing, who are perversely determined to annihilate their hopes for spiritual life, fail to be attracted. So this is 5:30, and actually at this junction, this is a very good place to stop. So we'll continue tomorrow, same time at 4:00, right here. So I would like to welcome those of you who are new. And if you liked what you heard today, then please come back tomorrow. We will continue this course on the Bhagavad Science of the Mind. This is a course actually on psychology in our... Nitai Gauranga Prabhu here is a Western-trained psychologist, so he gives some point of view from Western studies. And my purpose is to show you that a most complex and most elaborate science of the mind is given in the Srimad Bhagavatam. Unfortunately, many of us have overlooked it. We have failed to find these quotations that I am giving you, to understand how the mind works, how it becomes conditioned, so that we become just like vidbuja, stool-eating hogs, and how it can be reversed, how this conditioning process can be reversed, and we can become actually blissful devotees of the Lord, who have real taste for hearing and chanting Achyuta Katha, the nectarian glories of Lord Achyuta Sri Krishna. So thank you very much. And I hope to see all of you, and even more of you, tomorrow. Hare Krishna, Srila Prabhupada ki jai.
If you want when it gets darker, you can read off my computer.
Oh yeah?
Yeah.
My computer looks pretty dark too.
I have it blue with white ink. I don't know, it doesn't help my eyes as much. I could change it to white and black.
Okay.
Might be that way.
All right, that's a good idea.
Okay.
But it's just inordinately dark to me. Okay.
I wanted to confer apology from Rodasi. She wanted to call me every day, but she's sick. She has a jaundice, malaria at the same time.
Very bad.
But it's not an infection, jaundice is a jaundice connected with the blood. So it's even worse because, you know, her liver doesn't function.
Then she should get home immediately and go to a hospital.
Yeah, she goes to Delhi tomorrow by airplane, and she'll be there for 1 week because, you know, the manager of the Govinda restaurant with his brother is a doctor. She will stay there for 1 week and then she will fly back to Europe.
Okay. Anyway, that's a very dangerous situation because if the liver becomes damaged, then beyond a certain point, it becomes irreparable. It becomes irrepaired, and that's why he's holding his head over, left his body. It started off as jaundice, but he didn't. Well, I don't know what happened, but anyway, somehow the liver just got worse and worse and worse, and then it becomes hepatitis and.
Her whole face is yellow, also the eyes yellow. So she has to lie down all the time because
I had jaundice myself. Not that bad kind, but I remember for 2 weeks it was. Sometimes you're burning with fever, sometimes you're freezing cold. It's terrible. Yeah, she should get out of here.
So, and one more thing, actually. Do you think I could visit you tomorrow?
Okay, sure.
I mean, in terms of I can approach you tomorrow sometime.